Welcome to Drive Time GP, your trusted source for the latest healthcare news, specially designed for Australia's GPs. Interviews are available both online and through a private podcast. To subscribe to the podcast, explore more interviews, and access valuable resources, visit www.drivetimeradio.com.au or simply scan the QR code on your mailer. Don't forget, you can also claim CPD points for listening. Just head to our website for more details. Hot Flushes, a journey through vasomotor symptoms, mini-series. Part 1, Under the Surface, the pathophysiology of vasomotor symptoms.
I often say that menopause comes at the wrong time in a woman's life. Women experiencing the symptoms of menopause are often still raising children, they're often teenagers, and now they've got responsibility for supporting their aging parents. They're also often handling a full-time job, and sometimes they're having their very first brushes with chronic diseases like hypertension. Now, approximately 75% of women are going to experience symptoms during perimenopause and after menopause, with 25% experiencing moderate to severe symptoms affecting their quality of life. Vasomotor symptoms, or VMS, which include both hot flushes as well as night sweats, are basically the hallmark symptom of menopause. Vasomotor symptoms constitute a substantial burden to many women, disrupting their daily activities, negatively impacting sleep and mood, and decreasing overall quality of life. And so, unsurprisingly, these symptoms are the ones that we GPs will be asked to deal with as healthcare professionals to care for women during midlife. This is the first of a four-part series on vasomotor symptoms associated with menopause, and today we're lucky enough to be talking once again to menopause specialist GP Dr. Jane Elliott from Adelaide about the pathophysiology of vasomotor symptoms and the significant impact that these can have on women's lives. Jane, welcome back to Drive Time Medical.
Thanks, Jenny. I'm pleased to be here.
Jane, it's clear that women going through menopause and perimenopause experience troubling symptoms. Can you tell us about those symptoms? Because sometimes we only think it's hot flushes.
Well, for most women, multiple symptoms can occur in all sorts of configurations, but the vasomotor symptoms are the hallmark, as you said. And I thought I'd just mention that we talk about vasomotor symptoms as hot flushes and night sweats, and people sometimes think they're two different things. They're just different times of the day. So I think that's important. And when women are talking about hot flushes, I find that often they can get a feeling of anxiety or a feeling almost of dread. They say, I think something bad's about to happen, or I'm getting palpitations. And sometimes you actually have to say, and do you then feel a hot feeling? And they go, oh yeah, there's that as well. Because otherwise we can focus on those anxiety feelings and women end up getting treated for that. So just being aware that there's a constellation of things happening around the hot flush. The other things though that can happen as women, basically, their ovaries run out of estrogen, which is the hallmark of menopause, is what I call the old lady feeling. And that's the joint aches and muscle pains. Many women will talk about mood and cognitive changes, colloquially called the brain fog, and sleep disturbance, which can be related to the hot flushes at night, but it can be something on its own. Then there's low libido, which is multifactorial at any age, but certainly can be heightened at this point, and the genitourinary symptoms, which can be dry vagina, dyspareunia, or even increase of urinary tract infections. So it's quite a constellation there that women can experience, but it's really hitting women at a time of life when it can impact a vast number of things, relationships, work, quality of life. And the trouble is that the majority of women are either not seeking treatment or not being offered it. And I know it's difficult in general practice to be across everything, but I think this is something where if you've got any woman from 40 to 60 sitting in front of you, it could be part of what she's talking to you about.
Such a great point. Let's talk about vasomotor symptoms. As you said, the hot flushes and the night sweats, they are the most common reason for women to actually seek out treatment from their GP during the menopause transition. How common are they?
Well, you mentioned, Jenny, I think a number of 75%, depending on which study you look at, it's certainly somewhere between 70, 80% of women experience symptoms. That's the majority of women are experiencing symptoms. I think the important thing here is that the length of time they might go for. So it's really important that if a woman's sitting in front of you with symptoms, you don't just say, it'll probably be all over in 6 or 12 months, so you can probably hang in there. The median duration for hot flushes is 7.5 years. So obviously that means some less and some more, but this is years. And if you add in perimenopausal changes, it can be up to a decade of a woman's life at this pointy end of life that they're experiencing symptoms. In one study, 42% of women from 60 to 64 were still experiencing vasomotor symptoms. And basically 10% of women I'm still seeing in their 60s, 70s, 80s. It goes on forever. So menopause never stops. And no blood test will actually tell us which group a woman belongs to there. And when we talk about moderate to severe, we mean what impacts actual quality of life. It stops the woman working. It stops her doing her daily activities. That's in about 28% of postmenopausal women. So that's a significant number where it's impacting quality of life. And as I've said, despite that, one study showed that 85% of these women in the moderate to severe group were not currently receiving any treatment. In Australia, that's about 400,000 women not having treatment for symptoms that are severely impacting quality of life.
It's just unbelievable, those numbers. We used to have no clue about exactly how and why vasomotor symptoms happen, but that's kind of changed. Walk us through what we now know about the pathophysiology of the vasomotor symptoms.
Well, I thought I might explain how I explain this to patients, and we're going to have to visualise this, which I'm sure you can. The pathophysiology of vasomotor symptoms is still not completely understood, but if we go back to medical student days, we're aware that the hypothalamus is the thermoregulatory area of the brain. And when I'm talking to patients, I draw two horizontal lines on a piece of paper with a space between them and draw a squiggly line. And I explain that between those two lines, it represents the normal fluctuations of temperature as a woman goes through her day. When the temperature is contained between those two lines, a woman feels thermoneutral and is not experiencing any troubles. With the decreased estrogen, there seems to be an apparent narrowing of those two lines. So I then draw the two lines closer together, and that means the squiggly line is going outside the two lines, and that causes the perception in the brain of excessive warmth. And so the brain thinks, well, I've got to get rid of this heat, and that is the thing that leads to cutaneous vasodilatation, which is the hallmark of the hot flushes. It's interesting that the fact that most women restabilize at some point after menopause, eventually, and stop experiencing vasomotor symptoms indicates that low estradiol levels alone may not be sufficient to trigger vasomotor symptoms, and other mechanisms are at play.
Yeah, that's so interesting because, of course, we don't see hot flushes in women who've not yet, or girls who've not yet hit puberty. Some studies have shown that specific neurons in the hypothalamus might be the link between estrogen decline and vasomotor symptoms during menopause. What do we now know about this?
Well, I think this is the really interesting and exciting new area of research and understanding about hot flushes. Again, back to our medical student days, we know that the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis is responsible for reproductive function in women. So gonadotropin-releasing hormone, GnRH, is released in a pulsatile fashion from the hypothalamus, and that in turn triggers the secretion of FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone, and luteinizing hormone, LH, from the anterior pituitary. That elevated FSH and LH triggers the release of estrogen from the ovaries, and then that leads in a negative feedback effect on the secretion of GnRH. So I think we're aware of that cycle. That GnRH secretion occurs from a subpopulation of estrogen-sensitive neurons in the hypothalamus called the KNDY neurons. That's kisspeptin, neurokinin B, and dynorphin. And interestingly, those same neurons have projection pathways to the adjacent thermoregulatory area of the hypothalamus. So research has shown that in addition to the GnRH secretion, those KNDY neurons contribute to the regulation of body temperature. And in a premenopausal woman, the KNDY neurons are inhibited by estrogen and stimulated by neurokinin B in a balance. At menopause, again, you lose the estrogen, and that negative feedback is lost, and that disrupts the balance. So then you get unopposed neurokinin B signaling, and that increases the KNDY activity, and it actually leads to hypertrophy of those neurons in the hypothalamus. And that upregulation of neurokinin B and its receptor, and its receptor is actually called a neurokinin 3 receptor, not B, 3 receptor, and that inputs to the thermoregulatory area and results in a triggering of heat dissipation as hot flushes. So this is the exciting new bit of research that we understand contributes to hot flushes in women, the vasomotor symptoms.
So Jane, what does these new discoveries mean for women? How does that help?
Well, this breakthrough in understanding of vasomotor symptom pathophysiology has resulted in the development of several neurokinin 3B antagonists for clinical use. And we have a new one just approved in Australia. So this can offer women a new non-hormonal treatment that actually targets these KNDY neuron pathways. That treatment option will be discussed further in the second and third podcasts for this series. So this is very exciting.
Yeah, it is such an exciting area, but moving away from the science, this is affecting real women. What do you hear in your clinic every day? How does it affect women?
Look, I think all of us GPs would hear every day that the symptoms of menopause really can significantly impact. And if you take the time to, I often say, so what do you actually do when you get a hot flush? How do you deal with this? And when you actually listen to what women are doing, I've had women who've declined job promotions because of it. They've felt that they have to maybe leave work altogether. A common story is women saying they're feeling so bad in all sorts of other ways that they feel they might have to leave their relationship, or maybe they've left their relationship. The other feeling that many women comment on to us, and I think you'd be aware of that, is that they feel like they're going mad or they're getting dementia. So you hear of women at night, they're sleeping on beach towels. Some women say they're getting up every 45 minutes to change the beach towels. Then it takes them 15 minutes to get back to sleep. Just imagine what that does to our sleep. You only have to know yourself or any of us what it feels like when you don't sleep for a few nights. Imagine if you're not sleeping for a few years. Of course, that will impact mood. And the other issues of aging and a vulnerability to the development of clinical anxiety and depression can be there. I've got women who say they cling to the freezer compartments in supermarkets just to cool down while they're shopping. It really is significantly impacting women in those ways. So then if you see there is this sort of dance between vasomotor symptoms, poor sleep, mood and cognitive changes, and all of that feeds into each other, and every area of a woman's life can be impacted. I think the menopause in the workplace is now being recognised and taken more seriously. Menopause is now happening again. It has always been happening, of course, but we're paying attention to it, and we've got good options for women in treatment, and this story can be turned around dramatically.
Amen to that. I love that people are talking about it now. When's the best time to start chatting about this to women?
I think it's never too early, basically. Us GPs are the ideal first-line management. Of course we are, as we are for most things. The trouble is that we can be time poor. And I will stress that I don't believe you can do a menopause medicine in a short consult. Can't be tacked on to the end of another issue. So what I'd do is if a woman is bringing up menopause symptoms and she's come for something else and suddenly she brings this up, what I'd do is actually refer her to the Australasian Menopause Society or the Jean Hales for further information. Tell her, point her towards various videos and pamphlets, get herself to educate and say, I'd really like to book a long consult with you because this is so important, but could you do this bit of homework and then bring her back? So that's the first thing. I'd really suggest that any woman from 45 years at least, if not 40, should be offered information and advice. Not all women get symptoms or need treatment, but every woman should be given advice about what could be coming. If you are feeling that this is all sounding too hard in your busy general practices, another way is to offer women to come and see somebody, another general practitioner or another non-GP specialist who may be more interested in menopause. And the Australasian Menopause Society has an area on the website that says find an AMS doctor. So you could suggest that your patient goes for their menopause consult to someone else if this isn't your particular area of interest or expertise.
It's been a great chat as always. Jane, you're such a wealth of knowledge. What are your key takeaways for GPs who are listening to us today?
We know that vasomotor symptoms, which are the daytime flushes or the nighttime sweats, are experienced by the majority of women going through menopause. And it's not months, but many years on average that women could be experiencing, with some persisting forever. I think just being really aware of the magnitude of this. The pathophysiology of vasomotor symptoms is not completely understood, but their onset is thought to be change in that thermoregulatory area. And I think explaining that to women so that they can start to understand it. Really being aware how much vasomotor symptoms can interfere with work, social activities, leisure activities and sexual activity, and the impact on mood and sleep, total energy, every area of a woman's life. And from the age of 45 or earlier, giving women information at the very least in a long consult and offering the different management options for symptoms. And being aware now that because of our new understanding of vasomotor symptoms and the KNDY neurons, that we now have a new treatment that can be used for menopause, I think this is very exciting development.
Couldn't agree more. Dr. Jane Elliott, thanks so much for joining us on Drive Time Medical.
Thank you, Jenny.
Please note the following PBS information for Veozah, fezolinetant. This product is not listed on the PBS. Before prescribing, please review the Veozah product information. Product information is available from Astellas Pharma Australia Proprietary Limited by calling 1800 751 755 or accessible online via the TGA website or www.astellas.com/au/products. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Astellas Pharma Australia Proprietary Limited and produced in July 2024. Hot Flushes, A Journey Through Vasomotor Symptoms, mini-series. Part 2, Navigating the Challenges of Vasomotor Symptom Treatment.
The menopause transition represents a really significant change in a woman's lifetime, marking the end of her reproductive years and the decline of her ovarian follicles and consequently endogenous estrogen production. While all women will go through menopause, there is a substantial variability between women in the symptoms that occur due to the hormonal changes at menopause. Some women may be profoundly disabled by their menopause-associated symptoms, while for others, the hormone changes are just a minor inconvenience. First-line management of menopause-associated issues should be occurring at the level of primary care, so it's important that we GPs understand and offer the latest treatment options for symptoms associated with menopause. And yet, despite readily available menopausal hormone therapy and non-hormonal interventions, unfortunately, over 85% of Australian women with bothersome symptoms are not receiving any effective approved therapy. This is the second in a four-part series on hot flushes and night sweats. We also call them vasomotor symptoms, which are the most common reason for women seeking advice and treatment during the menopause transition. In the first episode, we discussed the pathophysiology of vasomotor symptoms and the impact these symptoms can have on women's lives. Today, we are lucky enough to welcome back Dr. Terry Foran. She is, as you know, a specialist at the Menopause Hub at the Royal Hospital for Women in New South Wales. And we're going to talk about some of the challenges in the treatment of vasomotor symptoms. Terry, welcome back to Drive Time Medical.
Thanks, Jenny. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's always great to have you on. It sounds like there is so much variation in the way people experience menopause transition. Do we know why that is?
No, we don't. And I think it's just that the experience is as individual as every woman out there. So some women have perfectly normal, regular cycles right up to their last one, and then it stops and they may or may not get symptoms after that. Other women who've had irregular cycles all their lives, it's difficult to even see when menopause is occurring.
Let's talk about vasomotor symptoms, which I think everybody thinks that the hot flush is going to be the sort of dramatic thing that happens in Hollywood, and often women are just running hot in general. I mean, not every hot flush looks the same, but do we know which factors make certain women more prone to hot flushes?
We know that there are risks. Again, I hate to generalize because some of these risks aren't there and people can still get terrible hot flashes or not. But we know that the heavier you are, the more likely you are to have significant hot flashes. There's a dual-edged sword there because women who are heavier tend to have more problems at the start of their menopause. And that's probably because they find it harder to radiate that heat, if you like. And also that adipose tissue, fat tissue, has an inflammatory component that's associated with it. Interestingly enough, as you go through the menopause, heavier women often have less hot flashes at the end because they're making a slightly higher amount of their own estrogen. But the message there is really that being overweight is never a good thing. And certainly, I think menopause transition and the time around menopause is a great chance to actually look generally at your health factors like your weight. And certainly we also know that things like smoking and alcohol are associated with an increased risk of hot flushes and for alcohol, an increased risk of breast cancer as well. So these are also issues I think are really important to address. Many women coming to menopause see it as a time of transition, a time of change, and a time to be making important decisions so that they live to a feisty old age.
We know that there's also this huge variability in the way people experience hot flushes. Do we know why that is?
We don't, I think. It's very individual. During the time when the hormonal levels are up and down and you're still cycling, you can get huge amounts of estrogen circulating. So not any symptoms associated with low estrogen, but things like breast tenderness and fluid retention and headaches that are associated with high levels of estrogen. I think the other thing that's important to know is that it's enormously variable in how long this happens and what sort of symptoms people get. So some women might get one or two vasomotor symptoms a week, and most of us could cope with that. Other people are getting it 20 and 30 times a day, and there are very few of us who can cope with that.
So given the variability of those symptoms altogether and then in terms of the frequency and severity of hot flushes, how can we help women manage all of these symptoms?
I think the first really important point is that we treat the women as an individual and we bring them into the discussion because really menopause is not a disease and we need to regard it as, if you like, a dialogue between us as the clinician who knows what's available and the woman and her personal preferences and decisions. So I think the first place to start is probably what I've been alluding to before, the whole lifestyle thing, because not every woman will want to or need to use any form of treatment other than to look at her lifestyle, improve her activity, lose some weight, get some exercise, cut back on the things she knows are bad for her. And I think that's probably step number one. And that's going to work for some women, but it's not going to work for everyone.
Let's just drill down a little bit about menopause hormone therapy. What do we need to keep in mind? Are there some broad guidelines there?
The gold standard has always been and still is menopausal hormone therapy. Progestogen and estrogen if you have a uterus and estrogen alone if you don't. And the reality with menopausal hormone therapy is it's incredibly effective once you get the right dose. But even then, it doesn't work for everyone completely. And I think it's important to guide expectations. But it is the gold standard and it's probably what we should be offering to women if they're keen to use it and there are no medical contraindications to its use. And again, I think a reasonable trial of that over maybe 3 months is the first place to start. It's important to take a good medical history to make sure that they don't have those contraindications, and it's important to monitor women while they're using it in case they develop problems. So I think that's all important. We can't use it in women who are contraindicated to use it. So if you've had a woman, for example, who's had a breast cancer in the past or another hormonally dependent cancer, it's really off the list. Depending on how severe it is, cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular risk factors are also going to factor in to just how safe it is to use it. And that is a wee bit controversial because we know that starting menopausal hormone therapy earlier is probably a positive. But if there's established disease, we're not so sure that it's all that useful in terms of risk. So I think that's one thing to be thinking about. The other group are women who've had a venous thromboembolism in the past. If it's provoked by something like a skiing accident or surgery, you still can use it. You would use something like a transdermal therapy rather than oral because that's considered safer. But if they've had a VTE on the pill in the past or they've had a VTE on previous menopausal hormone therapy, most experts would suggest that you should consider an alternative.
Interesting. So for women who you're talking about for who can't take menopause hormone therapy, do we have any other non-hormonal treatment options available? Like, are the over-the-counter products safe and effective?
Well, that's the problem. The real issue with the over-the-counter things is that there's not a lot of evidence, one, to show that they work, and two, to show that they're all that safe. We just don't have the evidence that, you know, shows that. So if somebody that I see has significant vasomotor symptoms, I'll tend to try and steer them towards something that has better evidence for effectiveness rather than steer them towards something that's available over the counter.
Yeah, it's so true. And I feel like there's just been this rush to market of all these menopause-specific supplements, and they're really quite expensive compared to a bog-standard multivitamin that you can get from Coles or Woolies. These things are pretty expensive and they promise a lot. It's amazing what they can get away with on the pack.
They do promise an enormous amount. And the real issue, I think, is that there's a huge placebo effect. If you want something to work, it does, or at least for some time. But really, I think it's important that a woman who has significant symptoms actually goes and speaks to someone like their GP who's got the real information that's going to help them. Now, that GP may, in the end, if they're really keen, support them in that decision to use something that's over the counter, if that's what they really want to do. But at least at the end of it, they've got somewhere to come back and say, oh, that didn't work. What can we consider now? So it's that checking in, I guess, with someone who has a little bit more knowledge and can also address some of those other lifestyle factors that are so important as we go through our 50s and onwards.
And what about pharmacological or prescription non-hormonal options for women? Do they work?
We have a couple of sort of tried and true, long-standing non-hormonal alternatives, which we've used for many years. Most of them are off license. It's really interesting. I think many of these drugs came out because they noticed during trials for what they really intended to be used for, that women reported a decrease in hot flashes. So it's a bit serendipitous, I guess. But the longest, I guess, tradition is to use an SSRI or SNRI in relatively low dosages. And they work, I guess, reducing by about 50 to 70%, depending on what you use. They were originally trialled in breast cancer survivors, and even in those trials, about 16% of women left the trials because of side effects and problems. So they're not without their issues, but they're an important, you know, option for women who can't or don't want to use estrogen. Gabapentin or pregabalin is also used. It's not widely used because it has its own set of side effects and problems, and I guess we all worry about habituation with it. But it's there. And I guess what we're increasingly using these days more and more is oxybutynin, which is a drug that's used to treat urinary incontinence, a pretty benign sort of drug and well tolerated. And it too seems to decrease hot flushes by about 50 to 60%. So they're there and we can use them as options, but it's important to understand that none of them are as effective in terms of what you can expect as menopausal hormone therapy itself.
Absolutely. We mentioned in the first episode in this series that there's been a breakthrough in understanding the pathophysiology of vasomotor symptoms, which is really exciting. And as a result, now we have new non-hormonal options for the treatment of vasomotor symptoms. Can you tell us about those?
Well, can I go back first, Jenny, and just say it's amazing that I think until the last few years, we didn't even know what caused hot flashes. We knew they happened since the 1700s, but we didn't know why. And I think now we do. So there's a part of the brain that has these candy neurons in them. When you're low in estrogen, these candy neurons act differently, and that's what causes our inability to stay within a sort of reasonable heat range in terms of heat control after menopause. What we have now is a new set of medications that actually target this specifically, and the neurokinin 3B that comes from this, it acts as an antagonist to that. And that means that we now have the ability to control hot flushes, vasomotor symptoms, with a completely non-hormonal form of doing that. And I think that's a breakthrough because until now that just simply hasn't been available in terms of the efficacy that we get with drugs like this. The studies show that it works, again, around about 50 to 60% in terms of reducing the severity and frequency of hot flushes. And side effects are few. We do need to be careful because it doesn't work on anything else other than vasomotor symptoms. But certainly in the patients that I've tried it on, who've been patients who can't or choose not to use hormones, it's actually been a real game changer because it works very, very quickly, and that's amazing. And many of them also feel, I guess, more comfortable with a choice that's non-hormonal. I think many women out there still have some reservations about using hormones, particularly for long periods of time. So for me, I think it's been a real game changer, and I really look forward to some of the data that comes out in the future with larger numbers of women using it. Our next episode is going to be talking about some of the more nitty-gritty aspects of making the prescription and ensuring that the woman is looked after both before and after the prescription is made. So I'm looking forward to listening into that one myself.
Great session. As always, Terry, thanks so much for talking to us about all the aspects of vasomotor symptoms. Can you summarise the key messages for GPs listening to our chat?
For me, I think it's important to realise that the experience of menopause and the symptoms around it vary enormously from woman to woman, and one woman's experience is not another. So I think that's important to be right up front about. I think the other message is I still think in most countries, menopause is undertreated. I think there's still a fair degree of resistance to menopause therapy out there, particularly hormonal therapy, and perhaps a good deal of misinformation. I think it's important to realise that for women who can't or don't want to use hormone therapy, we now have a variety of new options out there, most of which are very safe and very effective. And we now have another new option, which makes that even better in terms of choice for the patients we're looking after.
Love that. Dr. Terry Foran, thanks so much for joining us on Drive Time Medical.
It's an absolute pleasure, Jenny.
Please note the following PBS information for Veozah. Fezolinetant. This product is not listed on the PBS. Before prescribing, please review the Veozah product information. Product information is available from Astellas Pharma Australia Proprietary Limited by calling 1800 751 755 or accessible online via the TGA website or www.astellas.com/au/products. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Astellas Pharma Australia Proprietary Limited and produced in September 2024. Hot Flushes, a journey through vasomotor symptoms miniseries. Part 3, Cooling the Heat, a hormone-free approach for hot flushes.
Women can really suffer from their vasomotor symptoms, which encompass hot flushes and night sweats during the menopause transition and postmenopause. These symptoms can affect their quality of life, their sleep, their mood, but also their concentration. Vasomotor symptoms can start before menopause proper. They can often continue for more than 10 years, and they've been linked to a decline in many aspects of physical health. The standard care for vasomotor symptoms is hormone therapy, but not every woman can or will want to take it. This is the third in a four-part series on vasomotor symptoms. In the first two podcasts, we talked about the pathophysiology, but also some of the challenges in the treatment of vasomotor symptoms. Today, we're talking to Professor Rod Baber about fezolinetant. It's a non-hormonal alternative to hormone therapy, which is now available in Australia. Professor Baber is a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynaecology at the University of Sydney, also a past president of both the Australasian and the International Menopause Societies, and the recently retired editor of Climacteric. Rod, welcome back to Drive Time Medical. Always great to have you on.
Thanks, Jenny. It's good to be here.
So let's start by just doing a quick overview about what treatment options are currently available for patients with vasomotor symptoms.
Menopausal hormone therapy is the treatment that's been available for a long time. It is still the most effective treatment to alleviate menopausal symptoms, and it has additional benefits in helping cognitive health, cardiovascular health, bone health, and of course, quality of life. But as you mentioned in the introduction, not all women can take menopausal hormone therapy, and not all women wish to take MHT. So for those women, we've had another group of options available, including lifestyle changes, things like cognitive behavioral therapy or hypnosis, and a range of medications, most of which are used off-label for this indication, and most of which have some side effects, including sleepiness or dizziness and dysfunction as far as sex is concerned. But in recent times, there's been research done that's identified more clearly the mechanism behind the hot flush. And that's enabled researchers to introduce different approaches using that line of attack to alleviate the symptoms.
Yeah, you talked about that pathophysiology. In the first podcast in this series, we actually went right through the pathophysiology, but it's so important. Can you just recap it for us?
I think the key to this is the finding of the KNDY or candy neuron in the hypothalamus. It releases a few neuropeptides, kisspeptin, neurokinin B and dynorphin. The release of those peptides is controlled by the peptides themselves. Neurokinin is positive feedback to this candy neuron, dynorphin negative. But importantly, estrogen from the ovaries during reproductive life also provides negative feedback to control the output of the candy neuron. Now, there's two key things the candy neuron does. One is it releases kisspeptin, which controls the release of GnRH, LH, and therefore ovulation. The other is the release of neurokinin, which has effects on the thermoregulatory center in an adjacent aspect of the hypothalamus. So if we could control that, we would be able to help hot flushes. What happens at the menopause is the loss of estrogen leads to loss of negative feedback, and we get a surge of excess production of both kisspeptin and neurokinin B.
So the neurokinin 3 receptor antagonists have been developed to specifically target the mechanistic basis behind vasomotor symptoms. And fezolinetant, which is brand name Veozah, is a neurokinin 3 receptor antagonist that's now available in Australia. So can you talk to us about how the drug actually works to reduce hot flushes and other vasomotor symptoms?
So what this drug does is it affects the way the neurokinin itself binds to receptors in the thermoregulatory center. As I said before, once the menopause occurs, loss of estrogen feedback means more neurokinin, and the extra neurokinin disrupts our body's regulatory systems. We get too hot, and so the body does things to try to get rid of the heat, like sweats and flushes. If we produce a molecule that can interfere with the binding of neurokinin to its receptor, then we stop that effect or we reduce that effect. And that's how fezolinetant works.
So we've got quite a few phase 3 trials for fezolinetant now. Can you just talk to us about the data that we have around the efficacy for this compound?
Yeah, it was studied in a number of large randomized controlled trials. They were placebo controlled for 12 weeks. And after 12 weeks, the women on placebo were then randomized to one of two different doses of fezolinetant. It would have been cruel in the extreme to keep women who were having at least 7 moderate to severe flushes a day on a placebo for 52 weeks. What those trials showed was that there was about a 62% reduction in the frequency of hot flushes, which was seen quickly within 4 weeks, was at its peak after 12 weeks, and was maintained for 52 weeks. There's also a reduction in the severity of the symptoms of a similar order, just over 50%, which meant, again, that most of the women who had moderate to severe symptoms, which means symptoms that interfere with your way of life or your sleep, were reduced to mild to moderate symptoms. So the goal is not to get rid of them altogether, it's to make them things that you can tolerate and get on with your daily life with. There was also a beneficial effect as far as sleep was concerned.
Interesting. So we know that vasomotor symptoms do have that huge impact on quality of life for our patients. Have there been data looking specifically at non-vasomotor symptom outputs, things like, you know, your quality of life data?
They have. There's been a paper published, in fact, quite recently in Menopause, the Journal of the North American Menopause Society, looking at this data. Of course, they looked at the same things we've just spoken about, but they also asked women to say individually what they felt about the treatment. And they looked at vasomotor symptoms, and more than 50% of the women said they had significantly reduced and improved their quality of life. They also paired them, and they were able to show that more than 50% of women had experienced sufficient improvement in hot flushes that it also improved their quality of life. So two key areas, both improved. And similar data for sleep.
Veozah is now available in Australia. What patients should we GPs be thinking about as being appropriate for fezolinetant?
Yeah, that's a good question. You don't want to put anything, any drug, I don't think, into a box and say it's only for these women. So it, of course, could be used on any postmenopausal woman. The trial data is women from 40 to 65. They would need to understand that for vasomotor symptoms, the evidence is still clear, MHT is a more effective option. But as I said, there will be a lot of women who would prefer to avoid hormones. So I think this product could be offered to any woman who's interested in looking at a non-hormonal option, any woman who has tried hormones and found them unsatisfactory for one reason or another, any woman in whom hormones are contraindicated.
Yeah, it's a good point. Rod, what about the tolerability, the data for fezolinetant?
Ginny, it's been studied in over 3,000 women in trials that ran for 52 weeks. And overall, the treatment emergent adverse events were low. The most common were diarrhea and insomnia. Liver function tests have always been an issue with this class of medication, but the molecules have been changed to minimise that risk. And in those trials, liver function tests were elevated in 2% of women. There was no evidence of adverse changes to bilirubin, and there was no evidence at all, no women at all, had any hepatocellular damage. So very reassuring, I think. Endometrial safety was assessed during those trials as well, both by biopsy and by transvaginal ultrasound. Endometrial thickness did not change, and there were no signals in the biopsies to suggest an increased risk of either endometrial hyperplasia or cancer.
That is really reassuring. But when I listen to you describe the trial data, 50% reduction in vasomotor symptoms, efficacy around 60%, starting to work after 4 weeks, I think, yeah, that's okay. In my experience, it's been so much better for me, for my patients in the real world, than I was expecting from the trial data. What was your experience? And by the way, we are going to have an entire session in this series about real-world cases, but I just wanted to pick your brains about your clinical experience about using this.
Our clinical experience has been very similar to yours, really. The responses have been probably better than we expected. The response has been almost immediate, certainly within a couple of weeks, and that's very reassuring as well. And I've had similar reports from some of my colleagues as well. Now, I know that's all anecdotal, but I'm sure when you get to the next episode in this interesting series, you'll have much more data to dice through. But yeah, initially, I'd say very promising.
Finally, Veozah, it's an oral tablet. Talk to me about prescribing it. When do patients take it? When do you get them back to do a review?
Well, first of all, it is an oral tablet. It's single dose, 45 milligrams, taken every day, generally at the same time every day. If you miss a tablet, remember that you should take it as soon as you realise you've missed it, unless there's less than 12 hours to go before the next dose, in which case, wait. I think it should be reviewed regularly. I think the key to good patient care is to, when we start somebody on a new medication, get them back pretty quickly. Certainly, I would have said within 2 to 3 months to assess their response, to see if they've had any issues with it, and just generally to see if they're satisfied and there have been no side effects.
Thanks so much for talking to us about fezolinetant. Can you summarise the key messages for GPs listening to us?
I think the big take-home message is this is something extra that we have to treat women with. It's a non-hormonal treatment. It offers a targeted approach to directly restore thermoregulatory balance and does that by modulating the brain circuits that are triggered by the loss of estrogen at the time of the menopause. We have good clinical trial data that shows that Veozah, fezolinetant, at a dose of 45 milligrams a day, significantly improves the mean daily hot flush frequency and hot flush severity, that it was effective at 4 weeks and was peaked at 12 weeks and was maintained for the duration of the trial. The incidence of treatment-associated adverse events was very low. No women experienced liver damage in the clinical trial. Safety studies have not indicated any increased risk of endometrial hyperplasia or endometrial malignancy. There was no change in endometrial thickness on ultrasound in the control arm, and the treatment arm was the same. Single dose, 45 milligrams a day. You should assess it on a regular basis. As with all hormone therapy, I think it's certainly a very good idea to get your patient back within 2 to 3 months, see how it's going and adjust accordingly. The data we have is for a year. Once again, no reason to suppose you couldn't go on for much longer, but review your patient on an annual basis.
So practical. Love that. Professor Rod Baber, thanks so much for joining us on Drive Time Medical.
Thanks, Ginny. It's been a pleasure.
If anyone else is interested, as I am, in more sessions about vasomotor symptoms, we've got another one coming up, the final in our series. We're going to look at some real-world cases. Can't wait for that one.
Please note the following PBS information for Veozah, fezolinetant. This product is not listed on the PBS. Before prescribing, please review the Veozah product information. Product information is available from Astellas Pharma Australia Proprietary Limited by calling 1800 751 755 or accessible online via the TGA website or www.astellas.com/au/products. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Astellas Pharma Australia Proprietary Limited and produced in November 2024. Let's Talk Muscle Health, mini-series, part 3, the final piece to the muscle puzzle, prevention and management.
So far in this podcast series on muscle health, we've discussed when we should suspect poor muscle health in patients with risk factors, plus practical tips on how and when to screen for and assess poor muscle health. The final piece of the puzzle is how to manage poor muscle health, as well as preventative measures to keep muscles healthy, which is, of course, of vital importance for overall health, especially in those aged 50 years and over. For our discussion today, we are joined by two experts in muscle health, nutrition and exercise. Dr. Anthony Villani is Senior Lecturer in Nutrition and Dietetics at the University of the Sunshine Coast, and Associate Professor David Scott is Exercise Scientist from Deakin University. Welcome both to Drive Time Medical.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
David, in our last interview on muscle health, we talked mainly about the new Australian algorithm that's been developed to help GPs know when and how to assess muscle health. Can we talk about the physical activity recommendations for preventing poor muscle health and sarcopenia? What are some of the types of exercise to recommend, and are there barriers to exercise that we GPs need to be thinking about?
So the new Australian Muscle Health Monitoring and Management in Primary Care algorithm has been developed to aid in the early detection of poor muscle health and to help guide timely management. In the prevent component of the new algorithm, the recommendations are to advise patients to engage in at least twice weekly progressive resistance-based training. So the concept of resistance training can be quite daunting for both GPs and patients. It can be perceived as potentially dangerous or too challenging, and also potentially costly to get involved with. But we really think that GPs play an important role in driving engagement with this type of training, because there's strong evidence that people are more likely to engage with exercise if advised to do so by their GP. The most important component of progressive resistance training is the progressive component. Too often, patients get to a certain level and then remain there. But we know that once they can complete a certain type of exercise easily, it's time to increase the challenge in order to continue to make improvements. A good way to check if the way you're exercising is challenging enough is to use the Rating of Perceived Exertion scale, or RPE scale. So here the patient rates the challenge on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is essentially no effort and 10 is the most effort they could imagine. Resistance training should start out in the range of 3 to 5 RPE and progress to a 6 to 8 over time. And there's many ways that we can increase the challenge, which might include increasing the weight lifted, increasing the speed of the exercise, increasing the number of sets and or repetitions, or even just decreasing the recovery time between sets. We generally recommend 2 sessions per week of 30 minutes to an hour, involving 3 or 4 lower body exercises, such as a squat, leg presses, knee extension, and calf raises, as well as 3 or 4 upper body exercises, which might be a chest press, seated rows and pull downs. We also encourage patients to engage in some challenging balance exercises, such as standing on one leg. So although these types of activities don't build muscle mass or strength, they can be especially effective for preventing falls.
And are these the same kind of exercises that you would use for managing patients who are either at risk of low muscle strength or already have low muscle strength or low physical function, David?
Yeah, essentially it's the same recommendations for those who have current poor muscle function. So the muscle health algorithm recommends that management should also include prescription of at least twice weekly progressive resistance training. But ideally, we'd like to see this done via referral to an accredited exercise physiologist or AEP. Although resistance training is the gold standard for muscle health, the best exercise is the one that the patient will actually do. So as such, we need to work with them to identify types of exercise that they enjoy and can easily access. But I do think it's really important that we also try to break down those barriers to accessing resistance training, because it is really the key goal for exercise to support muscle health. And finally, beyond exercise, talk to your patients about movement. One approach we take is to encourage daily exercise snacks. Instead of completing a 30-minute block of exercise once per day, patients might complete 3 10-minute sessions across the day to make it more manageable for them, but also to break up long bouts of sedentary activity, which we know can be harmful to our muscle and general health as well. We also encourage patients to integrate simple functional movements into their daily routines. So examples might be doing a squat while getting into a chair, doing calf raises while you're brushing your teeth or making a cup of tea, or even just doing wall push-ups while watching the TV.
Such great points. Anthony, is physical activity on its own enough to prevent and manage poor muscle health?
Look, good question. And nutrition still does play an incredibly important role to help support exercise, as it provides fuel and nutrients that are needed to support muscle health. There are a number of nutrition interventions that are really important that will either support muscle anabolism, reduce muscle protein breakdown, and prevent malnutrition in older people. In particular, high proteins, because of its role in stimulating muscle protein synthesis. And this is because as we age, our ability to use the individual amino acids from protein does become compromised. And this is going to result in a lower muscle protein synthetic response.
And Anthony, what are the nutritional recommendations for preventing poor muscle health and sarcopenia? And how can GPs help our patients overcome some of those barriers to good nutrition that really do need to be overcome in this situation?
Yeah, definitely. From a nutrition perspective, the GP should really be focusing on education around the importance of diet quality and ensuring it's a protein-enriched balanced diet, ideally using a food-first approach rather than the need to turn to supplementation, and really advising on good quality proteins such as those found in dairy, eggs, meat and fish. With all of that said though, a multi-nutrient oral nutrition supplement which incorporates good quality protein and vitamins and minerals can be considered if the clinician believes that their patient might be nutritionally vulnerable or at risk for muscle loss. We certainly do need to appreciate that when it comes to nutrition, there are always going to be barriers to change. Early satiation and a reduced appetite will certainly make it more challenging for older adults to consume all the nutrients they need in order to maximise muscle health, particularly when it comes to protein intake. And then there are other things such as access to food, finances, and social isolation. These are also going to be important barriers to overcome and consider.
What about the nutritional recommendations for patients who actually already have low muscle strength and function? Can you tell us about the benefits of oral nutritional supplements for achieving adequate protein and nutrient intake for muscle health in those patients?
We would need to be a little bit more aggressive in terms of our approach. So, for example, education and counselling should be provided around optimising energy and protein intake, where the aim is for patients to achieve protein targets of about 1 to 1.5 grams per kilogram of body weight per day. And again, trying to achieve these using a food-first approach. A patient should also be encouraged to consume at least 25 grams of protein at each meal in order to counteract that blunted muscle protein synthetic response that occurs with aging. And lastly, patients should also be encouraged to evenly distribute their protein across the day rather than saving all of their protein intake for their main meal, which is another really good strategy to help mitigate that blunted muscle protein synthetic response. However, on some occasions, a food-first approach is not going to be adequate, particularly when patients report having a low protein intake, and this could be due to periods of poor appetite or illness or perhaps a hospitalisation. And in these instances, a multi-nutrient oral nutrition supplement, such as an Ensure, for example, is ideal because it's nutritionally complete. So it contains all the macronutrients and micronutrients in proportions that will improve nutritional status. But it also provides high-quality proteins that are going to support muscle health and stimulate muscle protein synthesis. And just lastly, whenever GPs are providing education on diet or nutritional supplements, it really is advisable that the GP strongly considers referring on their patients to an accredited practicing dietitian.
Yeah, great point. You did both talk about referral to other healthcare providers to help with the management of muscle health. I'm wondering if you can outline how to find and refer to dietitians and exercise physiologists who are experts in the field of muscle health and sarcopenia. And are there other allied health professionals that we should be involving in our patients' multidisciplinary care? Maybe, Anthony, I'll start with you.
Dietitians are really important allied health professionals when it comes to translating all of that scientific knowledge into practical information and strategies that are uniquely tailored to that individual. Importantly, dietitians are also recognised by Medicare, DVA and most private health insurers, and a local dietitian can easily be found on the Dietitians Australia website using the Find a Dietitian tool.
And David?
We do have compensable AEP services available via Medicare on referral from a GP with a chronic disease management plan, but also through the DVA, NDIS and private health insurers. And probably the best way to find a local AEP in your area is to go to the Exercise and Sports Science Australia website and use the Find an Accredited Exercise Professional tool.
Great tips. And finally, how should GPs be reviewing our patients' muscle health? Like, why are those frequent reviews so important, Anthony?
Yeah, good question. So in terms of how frequent, provided that there are adequate resources and training, the assessment of muscle health should be reviewed either annually or after the occurrence of a major critical event which may threaten muscle health, such as a hospital admission, a fall or a fracture, for example. And these ongoing reviews are really important to ensure patients don't fall below a disability threshold, which would then make them vulnerable to a loss of independence and all of those health-related consequences that are associated with poor muscle health that we spoke about previously.
Thank you both for talking about muscle health management prevention with such practical tips. Can you summarise the key messages for GPs to take for our conversation? Perhaps, David, I'll start with you.
Sure. Talk about the importance of exercise and muscle health with your patients. It's important to recognise that many older people see muscle declines as something that just happens when you age and isn't anything we can do something about. So we really need to drive those conversations with them to let them know that we can address it. Also, as I mentioned, help patients identify exercise that is suitable for them and break down the barriers to accessing resistance training, because we do know that's going to be the most effective way to improve their muscle health. But generally, just talk to them about movement, looking for ways to include functional activities in their daily routines. That exercise snacking approach is an example. But breaking up sedentary time and just looking for ways to be more active generally is really going to help your patients.
So practical. And Anthony, have you got some final words?
So from a dietary perspective, patients should also be provided education around optimising energy and protein intake, where the aim's to achieve protein targets of about that 1 to 1.5 grams per kilogram of body weight per day, and ideally including 25 grams of high quality protein at each meal. And practitioners should consider a multi-nutrient oral nutrition supplement that is nutritionally complete and incorporates high quality proteins for those patients who are unable to achieve their protein targets through food alone who may be at risk of malnutrition.
Fantastic information. Associate Professor David Scott and Dr. Anthony Villani, thanks so much for joining us on Drive Time Medical.
Thanks, Jeannie.
Thanks for having us.
Food for special medical purposes. Use under medical supervision. Available in pharmacies. Ensure is the number one oral nutritional supplement in the world, supported by over 30 clinical studies. Clinically shown to give 30% greater strength in 30 days in patients with lowest strength at baseline. Ensure Powder provides complete balanced nutrition with 28 essential vitamins and minerals, high-quality protein and prebiotic fiber to help in the dietary management of individuals who require increased nutrition, including those at risk of malnutrition or recovering from surgery, injuries or illness. Ensure also offers a range of higher calorie and protein liquid supplements that can be ordered in pharmacies to support muscle strength, immunity and energy in those at nutritional risk. For more info, visit ensure.com.au. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Abbott Nutrition and produced in July 2024. Dietary Challenges in Type 2 Diabetes, mini-series. Part 3, Case by Case, Practical Diabetes Nutrition.
This series of three podcasts on type 2 diabetes management has aimed to help Aussie GPs manage the dietary challenges faced by people with diabetes. Our first interview highlighted some of these challenges and gave us practical nutritional management tips from Diabetes Australia, while our second podcast outlined the consensus statement on the use of diabetes-specific nutritional formulas in people with type 2 diabetes. In our third interview, we'll bring it all together. We're discussing some real-world case studies to demonstrate how these practical tips and consensus recommendations can actually work in practice. To talk us through the case studies, we're joined by Dr. Gary Deed. He's a dedicated specialist GP and chair of the RACGP Diabetes Specific Interest Committee. Gary, welcome to Drive Time Medical.
Thank you so much.
Can we just quickly recap on diabetes-specific nutritional formulas and when you might consider using them in patients with type 2 diabetes?
There are specialised nutritional therapy that can be used to manage nutrition, dysglycemia and other cardiometabolic risk factors indicated for people with diabetes or pre-diabetes as part of a diabetes management plan, including diet and physical activity. A valuable short-term option for people with diabetes who are not able to adhere to a healthy diet, where their whole food diet is not achieving desired health outcomes, and certainly if their current dietary intake is not meeting recommended nutrient intakes.
So, Gary, I know you have a lot of experience with these diabetic specific nutritional formulas. So can we run through some case studies just to illustrate for GPs listening to us exactly where they fit in? I thought I'd start with a case that I don't know about you, but I see a lot of. So John is a 45-year-old with type 2 diabetes with poor glycemic control, particularly recently, and he's actually gained about several kilos over the last 10 years. He has a family history of type 2 diabetes, but he is a busy bloke. He is irregular with his eating. He skips breakfast. He often is snacking instead of having proper meals. And let's face it, he's a dud in the kitchen. He can't cook. Gary, what are the key issues for someone like John, and how do we GPs help him manage his diabetes better?
This is a very common case of a very busy person who's working hard, he's got inconsistent eating. The big issues with John is about how do we manage his diabetes, but also any weight gain and that irregular eating pattern that's really impacting on his diabetes risks as well as his health. Sometimes people do skip breakfast, and therefore their diabetes-specific nutritional formulas can be utilised to help re-establish that morning routine of to improve his nutritional intake, improve glycemic management, and also his overall health outcomes. And the best thing about them, maybe they come in a formula that's both calorie or kilojoule controlled, but they're also palatable. And so we're not going to add extra kilojoules or calories to him, but get him to get appropriate nutrient intake.
Yeah, such a good point. Can you tell us what happened when you did add those diabetes-specific nutritional formulas to his management?
Adding these formulas really established his morning routine to get that nutrition into him in a way that wasn't high glycemic. That is, it didn't raise his glucose levels abnormally. And so, therefore, we're getting nutrition without destabilizing his carbohydrate to glucose intake. Also, we're trying to address weight management because he's not now looking for snacks and inappropriately high kilojoule or high calorie intake as well. Remember that people with diabetes do struggle to adhere to dietary recommendations, and how do they incorporate a really good, healthy, whole food diet? And so these diabetes-specific nutrient formulas can give you a practical, simple solution to helping people like John with a busy lifestyle and unhealthy intake as well.
Gary, we've got lots of Johns and other patients in our surgeries with type 2 diabetes, and whether it's they're too busy or they work and travel a lot or they just don't have access to fresh food. You know, a lot of people in remote communities don't have great access to fresh food. Are there similar strategies that we would employ for those diabetics?
I utilise these to support people with diabetes who really do struggle with that adherence to healthy dietary choices and maintain weight. Certain medications can lead to nutrient deficiencies in diabetes. So I'm not saying that diabetes-specific nutrient formulas should be used to overcome specific nutrient deficiencies, but it gives you a broad base to the pyramid to allow a good nutritional approach as we try to introduce more healthy eating and more whole foods into someone's diet. Also importantly, though, we're not talking about them being used solely as a weight loss intervention. They're about weight maintenance and prevention of weight gain and supporting healthy nutritional approaches to what is aspect of diabetes, which is eating well and maintaining a healthy nutrient intake.
Let me give you another case study, another super common one. Let's talk about Janice, who's a 57-year-old lady with type 2 diabetes. And like many Australians, she's really got into her glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist, the GLP-1s. This time she's been on them for about 3 years, but it hasn't gone super well for her. She's had nausea. She has had weight loss, but she's also lost a fair bit of muscle mass at the same time. Unlike John, she's a pretty good cook. She manages all the meals for herself and her husband. She's a non-smoker. Is there any role for diabetes-specific nutritional formulas for someone like Janice?
So the nausea is a concern because GLP-1 receptor agonists do reduce somewhat the desire to food, but also the enjoyment of food. Not in everyone, but in someone like Janice, you want to be careful that they are getting a balanced nutritional intake. We don't want people to lose muscle mass. So weight loss with GLP-1 receptor agonists, that's one of the things I think about when I'm managing all patients, but particularly patients with diabetes. And so using the diabetes-specific nutrient formulas in this instance where Janice really struggled because her appetite and her intake was reduced. So we introduced them here twice daily to supplement her dietary intake, also being careful that they're not going to necessarily contribute to further weight gain, but we also use them with an exercise physiologist. So the underpinning of a good nutritional and lifestyle approach to a person's diabetes, but still getting the gains that some of these other therapies, such as the GLP-1 receptor agonist, can give us. So it's really about how the diabetes-specific nutrient formulas can be a valuable consideration to enhancing both protein and nutritional intake in people with reduced appetite from use of agents such as the GLP-1 receptor agonists.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. We're seeing more and more of it, right? So, Gary, what happened after Janice was given a diabetes-specific nutritional formulas?
It's really interesting. The diabetes-specific nutrient formulas can be presented in a form that's a liquid or a powder that's reconstituted. So we find that actually that is better tolerated by some patients. She can also spread the intake over a little bit longer than a very dense meal. I'm not suggesting that we replace all food with these, but it allowed her to supplement what was a reduced intake by something a little bit more palatable for her and less nausea was occurring. I was really impressed. It was a really effective clinical choice for this lady.
Yeah, it's such a great point. I know a lot of my patients who go on the GLP-1 receptor agonists actually don't have a lot of protein in their diet and they are seeing some significant muscle loss. So I think this sort of high protein option is a really good tool in the belts of GPs to manage patients in that situation. Gary, can I talk to you about a third case? Her name is Lynn. She's 78. She's had type 2 diabetes for 15 years and she's on the waiting list for a right total knee replacement. Now, she does live independently. She does cook for herself. She is a non-smoker, but this knee replacement surgery is really important for her well-being. What are the main issues for Lynn and how can they be managed in the post-surgery setting?
This, again, is not an uncommon scenario in general practice. And a person with a chronic illness of type 2 diabetes for more than 15 years, and we're not wanting to destabilize things prior to going for a major surgery. We want her nutrition to be maintained. We want her glucose management to be maintained, which is crucial. So the diabetes-specific nutrient formulas can be used preoperatively, but also postoperatively to give you some patient-focused support. So we're trying to get Lynn started on these formulas twice a day, also with low glycemic index meals to maintain stability of her glycemia prior to surgery, but also then after surgery, where normally she would cook for herself. There's going to be certainly a degree of pain and also mobility issues. And she really took that on board, trying to understand how these are valuable short-term option in those circumstances where maybe her ability to maintain a healthy whole food diet is a little bit compromised. And also to support any possible malnutrition that could occur, particularly in post-surgical recovery as well.
What were the outcomes for Lynn?
Well, Lynn, she really felt supported that we weren't just treating her from a purely medical point of view. We actually treated her for her lifestyle issues that really were her main stress. Yes, she was stressed about the surgery, but she wanted to have something where she felt supported, that she would be looked after around her nutrition, and also not to destabilize her diabetes management as well. So interesting but positive outcome here as well.
So do you think this would be a good option for patients in similar situations, like they might have lost some mobility, their appetite is down, their energy is lower, they're maybe looking at a period where they're more dependent? For example, you know, they can't go grocery shopping, cooking is a bit more difficult, they might have had some influenza, RSV. Can diabetes-specific nutritional formulas be used short-term in these patients just for adequate nutrition and blood glucose control?
You've really hit it on the head that these diabetes-specific nutrient formulas are good to supplement or as an alternative to whole food options when people aren't able to get out and about and cook for themselves or even go grocery shopping. And we know we've seen that, for instance, in COVID and influenza, let alone other viruses, RSV, for instance, which really can hammer patients pretty hard. And it allows me to know that the patients are supported through that period rather than having no safety net for them. It allows you to maintain good glycemic management and also looking at their overall health as well. As I said, they're valuable short term. I mean, yes, returning to a whole food diet is the optimal step up, but patients need sometimes that intervention to allow you and them to have reassurance that they're being supported from a very critical aspect of diabetes management, which is nutrition and glycemic control. So I just want to remind my colleagues that what we're talking about has been validated in a consensus statement supported by the Australian Diabetes Society. So have a read of the consensus statement, apply it in your general practice, and support your patients on another aspect of the journey of managing diabetes, which is sound nutritional support.
I love this session. It has been really informative, very practical. Can you walk us through the case studies on nutritional supplements for patients with type 2 diabetes and, I guess, summarise the key messages that you want GPs to take away from our chat?
So key messages for people here who are managing people with type 2 diabetes, that the evidence does support that these diabetes-specific nutrient formulas can be used as an alternative when whole food options are not feasible. They do support people with diabetes to optimize nutritional intake and improve glycemic management and also overall health outcomes. They are quite distinct, though, from other nutritional formulas that we use in people with metabolic conditions, including diabetes. So don't mistake them for very low energy dietary replacement, which are used around basically weight loss. Really consider them for overall protein and nutritional intake of people who are using GLP-1 receptor agonists. It's something, in addition to just prescribing these agents, think holistically and about how trying to support your patients by appropriate use of these diabetes-specific nutrient formulas. And as I said, when any patient, elderly, young, where they really struggle to adhere to whole food diet due to circumstance, surgery, it can be even cognitive decline, post-viral effects, all those things that affect ability to manage a whole food diet, then consider these when the current dietary intake is not up to meeting recommended daily intakes.
Dr. Gary Deed, thanks so much for joining us on Drive Time Medical.
Thank you.
Brought to you by Glucerna, a clinically proven diabetes nutritional supplement backed by 30 years of scientific evidence, proven to perform. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Abbott Nutrition and produced in September 2024. Thank you for listening, and remember to subscribe at drivetimeradio.com.au. We look forward to your company on the next edition of Drive Time GP. Please note that the information provided in these interviews is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Always review product information before prescribing. The views expressed are those of the individual speakers and may not represent those of the supporting organisation or Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited.